what you have to be able to do is take a non-formed particle and disperse it in a reactive fluid system precursor. Okay, so if you try to put a closed cell foam into the fluid precursor of an open cell foam, phase ratios are way out of balance, as you might expect. There's no way of mixing it up and putting it into a mold cavity and curing it up to what you want. So the composite system that we worked with was one where we designed special expandable beads. We can disperse those particles into the flexible precursor, foam precursor, and you know, you're only putting in about maybe 5%. So you hardly influence the viscosity of that system at all. And you pour it into the mold cavity, and as the foam rises, these particles are about the same density as the fluid, so they rise up and stay dispersed in that foam matrix. And then as the urethane starts to cure and develops the exotherm, it's the exotherm is enough to heat and heat plastify the particle and cause an in-situ expansion. So you have these particles dispersed throughout the open cell urethane. It's a system that I think we have a reasonably good. It hasn't really been market developed as well as it should be. I think one of the reasons for it is that people ultimately producing polyurethane foam don't particularly want to build something that's going to last a long time. They're willing to go ahead and produce a product of that kind, let the furniture manufacturers make something out of it, and hope that people dispose of it in a couple, 3 years, so that they can get another market for the foam. But I don't know whether you will ever see those type of systems develop. They offer a lot of improvements as far as material performance, but I'm not sure that they're in the market that they'll ever take major advantage of them. Of course, Ethafoam, you know, has become premier packaging for electronic equipment, and that's where its major markets have developed. It turns out that there's a lot of opportunities to improve virtually every foam that we've got, to improve its performance, and I'm curious myself whether Dow will really do the required basic work, or whether any other firm will. See, one thing that strikes me, I've gone to Gordon conferences on foam ever since they've started back in 1954, and I've always been rather surprised at the relatively few people there are worldwide who go to the fundamental conferences on foam science. They seem to be pretty much the same ones all the time, and relatively few young people. So I'm not seeing what I think is people doing the basic research that could really enhance the use of products of that type in the way it should.
Just as an aside, I live in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Just south of us is Hazleton, and there is a General Foam Corporation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
in Hazleton, are you familiar with
that? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We've got some of our chemistry majors employed there from time to time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Jobs. The only person I know there is Herman Stone, who's active in our.
Well, there are a lot of, you know, there are a lot of foam producers. There are relatively few people, though, who are really doing much in the fundamental problems of involved with foams. It's funny, too, because probably 10% of all polymers are being sold in the foam form. There's a lot of areas where you could identify it. But Lord, what better place to put a low-cost filler than in the neutral axis of a structural foam. You gain a lot in modulus. Your stiffness is enhanced so much for nothing more than a little know-how. But see, always, we don't, in a company like Dow, we do not do very well on processes that require significant mechanical fabrication. Some of the older ones that we've had, you know, like, for example, making SRAM film, or making the extruding styrofoam or ethafoam, materials of that kind, and maybe even today making Ziploc bags. We've got some good plants to do that, but overall, we have not taken advantage of a lot of the fabrication technology that this company developed. I don't think they've had to, though. See, they've always had good processes for the basic products. You could pretty much depend on year after year that as long as you stayed competitive and those products could be sold, that you were going to make a good return. And anytime you come to making specialties, you were always more vulnerable to somebody meeting that particular need with a lower cost or a better performance. I still think that's the sort of thing that people are going to run into. In fact, I look at the overall chemical industry today, and I'm hearing the same thing from all of them, that we're going to concentrate on specialties. At the same time, you know, I'm looking at even starting with somebody like General Electric here, where they cut their personnel by 100,000 people in the last 4 years. DuPont has cut 25,000 out of 140. Dow is down from 64 to 52. You know, my perspective on all of those things is that if you're truly going to make specialties, you have more customer service and all, and you don't do it with less people, you do it with more, huh?
Mm-hmm.
And so here all, virtually everyone, whether it's Carbide or Olin, any of those companies. My son is general manager of the Ramset division of Olin. It was Olin, now it's Illinois Tool. Interestingly enough, you know, they were doing, it seemed to me, a pretty good business. And fact is, see, when he and I talked about it, both their sales and profitability looked like it would be a pretty good thing. But Olin was saying, you know, what we would like to do is do things that are consistent with our long-term profit goals. Well, from what their overall profit was on sales and everything, it looked to me like they were doing a hell of a lot better with that division, but it seemed to me the decision was made to sell it while it's making a good profit. It's going to help our cash flow, and I see that in this industry a lot. Maybe you do, too, and that you know, I think profitable divisions are being sold off because the management at that particular time says, well, it's not it's not consistent with our long-term goals. But I always, when I listen to something like that, I always think, well, they're kind of short on money and they're looking to raise a few bucks, particularly if it's been a winter, you know. So it's a... I think that you don't, you in research, you never get that, you know, the view, the clear view of what management is thinking, what their reasons are for doing a lot of stuff. And they sure spell must know more, a lot more about why they make certain moves than I do. But it doesn't mean that you can't think about about them as you watch them. But I'll tell you one thing about Dow. It's always impressed me. I think back when I came out of the $39.5 million sales, I think they had $1.5 million research budget. And in no time since I've ever been there have they ever reduced their research commitment. And if you go back and look at all their annual reports and look at what their support for research is, it's a curve that just goes like that and keeps going and going. The question of whether the research results have been used wisely, maybe something to debate. But I don't think that the upper management in Dow has ever failed to honor their commitment to research and development in this company. And we've gone through a lot of managements over the years.
Well, that's fascinating, and I appreciate those views. I have a list of names, some people we've mentioned, most of them already in one form or another. I guess one person I did want to ask you about is Sylvia.
Mm-hmm.
She was already in the physics lab.
Sylvia was, to the best of my knowledge, the first woman chemist hired by Dow. I don't think they even had female Johns when she was hired. But she worked, in the very early days in styrene, and to the best of my knowledge worked on some very early work on inhibitors and the monomer purification. And she had, I don't know how long she stayed. She was gone from the lab when I came.
Oh, she was?
Yeah. But then she came back. We had the project... I'm writing the book going, of course, and even though it was written almost entirely by Dow authors, there seemed to be a big problem in coordinating everyone that they'd come in at the same time with the final draft. And this, of course, is a time also when when polymer science was moving along very rapidly. So I know I remember writing my chapter, writing with Ray in that first draft, maybe back in 48, 49, something like that. But I think before it finally ended up in the final publication, I went back and had to go back to the literature at least twice. But it wasn't coming to a point where it was... where we were getting into final publication, and they brought in Boundy and Boyer, brought in Sylvia to replace they had a woman earlier that had been a librarian, Ted, but somehow she didn't bring it all together. But Sylvia, when she got in the scene, I think maybe it was her technical experience that she had in the area and all, but she was able to, the knowledge of the individual people involved that helped her, but she brought it to fruition and I think really played the very key role and getting their publications in.
Did you have much interaction with Turner and Alfred?
Oh yeah. Turner and I had a lot of interaction. We both in the back at the plant, but also outside. We played golf together, played cards together, poker and everything. Back in that yellow green book, I wrote a little bit on him playing his golf and his. This card playing, but internally, it's always kind of interesting. I had a great deal of respect, of course, for Turner. I considered him certainly the best teacher of polymer science or any science that I'd ever encountered. And I had a great deal of faith in his capabilities. Quite a times I'd go to him and discuss an idea and leave the write-up with him, And I used to get a kick out of him because usually about 2 weeks later I'd either get one of Turner's inner office memos, with just the note on it, "That's right, Turner," or something like that. Or if he didn't agree, he'd have, "Let's come on over, we'll talk about it," or something like that. So, but we did. We interacted that way over the years. And I found him to be, I guess, like everybody else did, a very fascinating, competent scientist. Certainly, tremendous sense of humor, but a guy that was fun to be around.
I have a quote that's attributed to you, and I thought this might be a good place to close with, if you care to comment on this. He said polymer science was in its infancy, going back to the early days at Dow. There was a wide open opportunity, but our sophistication level was low. We had neither knowledge or experience. We were starting from scratch.
Pretty much so. Yeah. Well, I felt that way industrially. We were, certainly there was experience out there. And there were some very good scientists who had made contributions. But as far as Dow was concerned, there was very, very little. There'd been almost a commitment by Dow to go in the direction of natural polymers. That's why we had the Cyclos lab. That's why we had so many plantations of popple and softwoods and everything around here to supply cellulose. And that was because Herbert Dow had believed that that was the direction to make we would go to make polymers. So in Dow, this indeed was the case. We had virtually no one in Dow at the time when I started that knew anything in depth about polymers. Wiley was already, working on SRAM and so forth, but there really wasn't very much knowledge about how to process these polymers. The equipment at the time for even injection molding, the old RAM-type machines with a torpedo in it. People really knew very, very little. I think a lot of the work on rheology was just started to develop. You go back and look at people like Spencer and Dillon, who did such interesting work on rheology of polymers. It's still kind of classic stuff today. So there was tremendous opportunity. If a person really wanted to work on it, we could if we could stand on the shoulders of our predecessors and hopefully get some better perspectives of where we ought to be going, but a lot of it was pretty much uncharted.
You had commented to me earlier about Herman Mark, that he always gave more than he took away.
Sure.
And I understand that from others, that when he visited a company, he was really lecturing and educating people.
Precisely. You know, Herman had, I think, had such widespread respect for his competence and the kind of an individual he was over the entire world, that I think people were actually anxious to talk to him about their specific developments, mm-hmm. about their achievements. And generally, it was not too secret. I've never known him in all the time that he worked for Dow came to Dow and talked with us. I've never known him to violate a confidence ever. And if the things that he was free to talk about, he talked about. But he could talk about them in such an interesting way that it sort of inspired you and made you enthusiastic to think about working with doing polymer science.
Well, on that note, we've been going for quite some time this morning. And I certainly appreciate your time and sharing all of this with me. It's really been quite fascinating. Thank you.
Yeah, you're most welcome.